Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskans.
This is Chinook Patterns. I'm Paula Schiller. 14H1 is a section of the Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act, providing for the selection of culturally significant historic and archaeological sites in the various regions. The first phase of implementation was the nomination process. In Southeast, that was done through an outside consulting firm. Now, the Cooperative Park Studies Unit at the University of Alaska is working on phase two, which is on-site documentation. In Southeast, that means looking around and asking questions about some 96 Sea Alaska sites. Russ Sackett is a research associate with the CPSU. He's been working in Southeast, and he describes how the research teams approach the job.
Hopefully, our research starts before we get into the field. What we would like to do is be able to sit down and do a brief archival library search on each site, obtaining historic documentation of early exploration in the area that may have visited the site. If there's any other anthropologists or archaeologists or anyone else that has done any type of research in the area, whether or not they've had visited the site and what they've done with the site, so that when we go into field we'll have some idea of what the importance of the site was, what we can expect to find there. In addition, it's hopeful that we'd be able to interview some of the informed people in the area that may have had relatives that lived at the site. In Southeast Alaska, most of the sites we're dealing with were permanent villages up until the early 1900s and when they were abandoned. So many of the older people in the Southeast have either lived in the sites or have visited the sites or had relatives. So there's just a lot of information that can be obtained from people. And it doesn't always work out, but we would like to be able to interview these people before going into the field and getting a better feeling of what we're going to be looking for. And once we arrive at the site, it's basically doing a transect of the site, just walking over the site, identifying different cultural features, smokehouses, old ruins of, houses, cemeteries, middens, anything you'd associate with human activity. And then once we have identified that cultural material, we can sit down and start deciding where the site boundaries are. For the conveyance purposes, we have to delineate the area of the site, and we take in consideration the cultural activities, what the site was used for, whether it was just a seasonal village or a permanent village or a subsistence mm-hmm. camp. And then along with that, we take in consideration of visual integrity of the site, which kind of takes in the realm of, why was the site located here in this part of the bay and not, someplace else, the physical features that it had to offer. And so with those two things combined, we try to, delineate where exactly the area of the site is.
What are some of the other kinds of sites? Villages or camps would be, that's easy to visualize, probably easy to justify including, but you have other things that are included?
Well, the sites in Southeast Alaska range from, we have one site that's been selected that's prehistoric, and it was excavated by Robert Ackerman of Washington State University in the mid-60s. It's a Groundhog Bay site, too. Dates approximately 10,000 years ago. Fortunately for us, it was a permanent village site that was occupied up until approximately the 1920s before it was abandoned. So there's a lot of surface evidence of the village, and basically, this our program is just to identify the sites and, you know, say that they do exist. And in the cases where there's a lot of, you know, surface evidence, then we don't get into archaeological testing. If there weren't any surface evidence, then we do archaeological testing. So that's the case. That's one example mm-hmm. of one of the sites. It's prehistoric, you know, dating back 10,000 years and goes up into the 20th century. And then we also have quite a few petroglyph sites and pictograph sites. And they tend to be smaller. They're an important site in Southeast Alaska because there's really not that much known about, you know, who carved the petroglyphs, why were they carved, and what do they really represent. There's a lot of, you know, speculation as to, and some of the features, or some of the petroglyphs are known ethnographically and why they were put there. But for the most part, they're beyond ethnographic information.
Ethnographic for me.
Oh, ethnographic is basically just, you know, the material you obtain through interviewing the older native population or, you know, people that are familiar with the area.
So through either stories or people that may have witnessed, you know that...
Or may have even done it. In the case of the one petroglyph site, there's one specific petroglyph. There's a number of petroglyphs at the site, but there's one that's of a tina or a copper shield, which is known ethnographically, although it's before any of the living people today, you know, when it was carved. It's known ethnographically because of a specific in Angoon when there was a disturbance between two clans, and then the one clan had to vacate the area and move out. And when they moved, they carved this petroglyph at the site to as a representation of the wealth that they were giving up to this other clan. So in cases like that, there is some ethnographic material, but for the most part, the petroglyphs are, you know, before the present population. And a lot of them are pre-Tlingit, so, you know, there's not that much information on them.
There's still a lot of work once yet to be done.
Oh, yeah. I think, you know, for the most part, the Southeast has been somewhat overlooked archaeologically. Ethnographically, there's been a lot of work, you know, mainly in the 40s and in the early 1900s. But archaeologically, it's probably one of the more overlooked areas of the state.
You always think of Southeast as being fairly well gone over because it's always the first to be hit from the move from the south. And
ethnographically, it's really been hit. And even today, there's a lot of people going through collecting stories and, you know, the history of the area. And that proves somewhat of a problem for us because in a lot of cases, the people are being ripped off for their material. They go in and give their stories and their histories to the people, to writers and other people. Not in every case, but, you know, I think it happens enough.
And they're probably just tired of it, too.
They're probably tired. I don't know if they're tired of it, but what happens is a lot of people go and publish the material, and, you know, the people that they collected the information from really sees no reward or anything from that. And so it takes a while. Sometimes it's no problem for us, but a lot of times we'll have to just establish, you know, a trust between the people and, you know, let them know exactly what the material is being used for that it's not being used for publication or, you know, my financial welfare, and that it's, in the end, it will be a benefit to them because through the material that's collected from them, it's needed for conveyance purposes to establish the importance of the site within their heritage.
Is your training mostly in archaeology or more scientific end, or do you have the cultural training as well, of knowing a little bit about the culture you're going into and maybe how to behave or how not to behave and some of the things that could be important?
I've gone through the anthropological program, which is archaeology under anthropology. and you know through the courses and all, you get a general feeling for you know how to conduct yourself. But I don't think you can really get anything like that in a classroom situation. I really didn't learn doing that until you actually get in the field. You know, nothing's really textbook perfect. I think the first year that I was doing it, I was probably a little hesitant about it just because of going into an area that my you know knowledge wasn't really that up. You know, and under this program is the first time I've really had to conduct in-depth interviews with people. So it took me a couple interviews to really get down and you know realize you know how the people conducted themselves. You know, it's a little different in you know how my sitting here and talking mm-hmm. to you. It's not that big of a difference, but you know after a couple of interviews, you become more relaxed and you know you kind of let the people do more of the talking and you know just ask the pertinent questions. And I really enjoy doing it. It's probably one of the more enjoyable parts of the job for me. And I find that the older people that I talk to, once they trust you and get to know you more, really enjoy having someone to listen to. You know, they enjoy talking to someone that's willing to listen. And they're just really a wealth of information for the sites we're doing. Makes the job a lot easier.
Do you get in any problems with ownership of areas, with clans saying, you know, this is ours, and or people feeling that their ancestors, you know, were on this site and therefore it's really theirs and not?
Yeah, you get that a lot with you know the older generation. They traditionally they view it as their land and. Because of the circumstances of why they left the land, they don't really feel that they've given up ownership. It's still their clan's ownership. And one of the tougher questions that they ask you occasionally is, why are you conveying this land to us? We already own it. You know, how did we lose this land? You know, and that's a hard question to deal with when you're talking to the people. And sometimes I go into an interview hoping that they don't ask me that question, because I find it a hard question to answer, mm-hmm. and so hopefully I can
and say I don't
smooth
know.
Over that mm-hmm. answer, you know, say I don't know, and hopefully get through that and get into the interview.
Russ Sackett and the other Cooperative Park Studies Unit researchers make an effort to get the information they gather back to the villages. That's not always possible, but the reports are generally accessible through the regional corporations. I'm Paula Schiller. You've been listening to Chinook, a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaska Natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
This is Chinook Patterns. I'm Paula Schiller with the third part of a series looking at how the Cooperative Park Studies Unit at the University of Alaska documents 14H1 sites. 14H1 is a section of ANCSA which entitles the regional corporations to select historic sites. Working last summer in the Prince William Sound area, where Jim Marcotte, who you will hear later, and Jim Ketz, who describes some of what they encountered.
It's kind of an isolated area. So there's a lot of logistical problems dealing with weather and boats and that kind of thing. It's also dealing with people. That takes some certain skills that you don't learn in the classroom, too. And so it's really requires a lot of, like you said, things that you don't learn in the classroom to do well. We haven't had any major accidents so far. We've had some...
A few mishaps,
but nothing really serious that jeopardized either life or limb.
Like boating mishaps or getting lost?
We haven't gotten lost. We know the area pretty well, and it's pretty straightforward. You're dealing with islands and coastlines, so there's not too much of a chance of getting lost. Weather has been a problem. Last spring we had, when we were first out in the field, we had a tremendous gale come whipping down from the mountains on us and flattened our camp. Tents, and these are huge tents that we, Bureau of Indian Affairs had supplied. We're sailing off down the beach, and we were standing, this was at night, ended up standing out in the rain and the wind in our underwear. Weather is a problem.
Does that, the kind of weather you encountered, help you give any insight to what you're uncovering? Does it all relate to the kind of thing that you might be digging up?
I think so. A lot of the serious storms come out of the southeast. It's a set pattern, and that does have its implication on where the sites are located. Many of the village areas are such that they're protected from those southeast winds.
How old are some of the sites when you're...
Well, that's one of the interesting things about this area is that that Chuyach Natives Incorporated, who identified the sites initially, selected a wide range of sites, wide range in terms of the time periods that they represent. So not only do we have some important prehistoric sites, but we've got some important sites that go through the entire historic period in Prince William Sound, which dates back to Cook's voyage in 1778. And I think that we're gonna look on Kayak Island, which is Bering's landfall, and maybe look for some of the sites that Steller and a few of his scientists on board that voyage have described.
Have those kinds of things been selected?
Yes. There's no site per se that's going to represent the what Cook described in 1778. But I believe that we haven't seen all the sites come through pre-adjudication yet. But some of the sites on Kayak Island supposedly represent that time period, 1741. What Bering or what Steller described there when they made their landfall. So it's, and then we move into more recent, the Russian period, for example. Nuchek, I think, illustrates that time period. It's the site of the Russian redoubt. And then after the Russians, it was the site of the Alaska Commercial Company station. And there are other sites associated with that time period. So we've got sites that represent the whole fur trade era, which is a fascinating thing in and of itself.
You're talking about sites that have really statewide interest.
For sure, right.
Does that complicate things or make it easier? Or
it makes it complicated because in some extent because people want to see that significance within the broader context of Alaska history, which is certainly valid, but then they tend to overlook the fact that it was people who were living in the Sound at that time that made this whole thing happen. You know, it was really the native people of Prince William Sound that were the support of the entire fur trade, which I think tends to be overlooked or in terms of the broader significance of, say, North Pacific exploration or the Russians in Alaska, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're about, I think, is documenting Native history. And we want to emphasize that perspective.
I'm not sure how well populated Prince William Sound is now. What are the, there's what, Cordova and...
Cordova, Valdez, Whittier, Seward's not really in the Sound itself.
Are those places, though, those are towns like Whittier is...
Whittier is essentially a white,
yeah,
white community. Valdez, I think, is essentially white. There's a sizable Native community in Cordova.
But do any of the towns that exist now correlate to older villages or older sites?
Tetiutlik does, I think. It, at least there's a continuity in the name, if not the exact location, although the present village site seems to be in the general area where there's continuity back through the entire historic period. And there were only a few major villages in the Sound from what the earlier explorers were able to determine. Tetiutlik being one of them.
So it must have at one time been more populated than it is now, I'm just guessing, with all this activity.
Well, that's a very interesting research question. Comparatively speaking, compared to the Kodiak Island, for example, and some of the other coastal areas of Alaska, from what the what can be reconstructed from the historical accounts, it seems that the resident population in Prince William Sound was extremely low.
Hmm.
And that's going to be a major, I think will be a major research question to determine exactly why that is, why that seems to have been so, whether there were some climatic variables happening during the more recent period, comparable to the retreat of the glaciers in Glacier Bay, for example, whether there was something comparable happening in Prince William Sound, or whether there is something about that local environment that precludes a large population being there.
I was wondering if any of those things that you might have been speculating on in your travels there. Reasons?
Oh, yeah. See, that seems to be a constant source of speculation on our part when we're out in the field. We don't have any answer for it. We've been dealing with, or at least had contact with, biologists working out in the area, and we always hit them with those kind of questions, like what was the carrying capacity? What is the carrying capacity of Prince William Sound in terms of... The marine life in Prince William Sound, and get into discussions about that type of thing. I don't know if it's going to take a little bit more effort to come to any kind of conclusions about the reasoning for that, but it will be an interesting one to deal with.
We've talked about different sites. Are there any sites that are particularly... only Native sites? We've talked about the ones that may have statewide interest with the Russians and the fur trading and Captain Cook and some of the prehistoric sites.
Sure, Jim's done a lot.
So we have quite a few sites like that.
You just have to describe them because I have no idea.
Okay, a common site type that we find in Prince William Sound are smokehouse sites. And these are locations where the Chugach had smokehouses where they put up the fish for the winter. And on the order of 4,000 to 5,000 fish might be put up for an extended family group for the winter. And smokehouses are commonly located right at the mouth or very close to the mouth of a salmon stream.
Mm-hmm.
One noted for having a strong salmon run year to year. We found an interesting function of this smokehouses was that it was a marker for the right to use that salmon stream. And so it was, in effect, like a resource use or, in effect, ownership marker for it. Other site types and smokehouses, hunting cabins scattered throughout the Sound, a lot of just seasonal resource sites, such as an area people went to collect strawberries, sites where people went to collect bird eggs in season.
It seems odd that you'd be able to put a site that was, you know, a good berry patch into a historic site selection.
Okay, part of why we take that approach is that that site in itself represents a single activity, but of say, you know, collecting a certain plant species, but put in the context of a whole pattern of seasonal subsistence cycles, that site then plays a very important role in an annual subsistence pattern.
We're taking a very broad perception of what is meant by historic. We're trying to get at it from a more emic rather than an etic approach.
Wait a minute.
Trying to look at Native history more from the perspective of the people there, rather than from the perspectives of our culture, mm-hmm. and dealing with history from that kind of an angle, rather than from perhaps the, you know, some of the ideas that are more common in our culture about what comprises history.
Yeah, how on earth do you do that, though?
It's a difficult thing to do. obviously, we're not part of that culture.
I think we rely very heavily upon the perspective of our resource specialists, and we'll go load up in the boat and go tour around part of, say, Hinchinbrook Island with them and spend the day observing, you know, what does this resource specialist see as important? What are the sites? What are the locations? What are the aspects of the area that they pick out as being the most important?
Jim Marcotte and Jim Ketz of the Cooperative Park Studies Unit. They worked on 14H1 sites around Prince William Sound. We'll hear about what's happening on the Seward Peninsula and in the interior on the next two programs. I'm Paula Schiller, and this is Chinook, a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.